This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, Governing to Win, exploring ideas to enhancing national competitiveness. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. The IBM Center for the Business of Government recently published Governing to Win, Enhancing National Competitiveness Through New Policy and Operating Approaches, edited by Chuck Pro, which brings together insightful ideas by leading thinkers and practitioners that offer a long-term strategy to improve national competitiveness. What is national competitiveness? How can our nation better compete in today's global economy? What's driving the annual federal deficit? And how is governance the new competitiveness imperative? Today we will explore these questions and so much more with my guests Larry Haas and Gail Fossler. First up, I'd like to welcome Larry Haas, contributor to the recent IBM Center book, Governing to Win, and author of his recent book, Sound the Trumpets. Welcome, Larry. It's great to have you on the program.
Nice to be here.
So, Larry, I've asked every one of our contributors to the book, Governing to Win, what is national competitiveness?
Well, of course, the root is competition or compete, and it really has to do with a country's place in the world. And to the extent that you want to improve U.S. competitiveness in this case, you need to create the right economic environment. You need to have the right monetary policy, regulatory policy, fiscal policy. So you want the Fed to be handling monetary policy correctly, and you want policymakers not to be overregulating, not to be overtaxing, and on the spending side, to be investing in the kinds of things that grow an economy. That has to do with hard things like infrastructure, roads, bridges, internet, so that businesses can be competitive. And on the human capital side, it has a lot to do with education. You want to make sure that you've got a workforce that's well-educated and skilled so that they are ready for the increasingly sophisticated jobs of the future. So in essence, what you're doing, to the extent that you have a competitive nation, you have followed and created the policies that put your businesses and your people in a position to win in an increasingly competitive global environment. That's what competitiveness is.
So, Larry, at first blush, the problem of a growing federal deficit seems straightforward to fix. The government is spending more than it is collecting in revenue, and policymakers need to close this gap. But you point out in your piece that it's far more complex than that. Could you elaborate on what composes this complex reality?
Sure. You know, I give a lot of speeches about the budget, and I often get the question very much in the way that you posed it. Well, what's the problem here? We're just spending too much. Let's just cut spending. And people seem to have this sense that the budget has a category which is called spending, just spending writ large. It's this kind of metaphysical thing. But the budget, of course, isn't just spending. It's real things for real people. They're there for a reason. We either want them or we need them. When you look at the budget, think about what dominates the budget. Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, national security, homeland security, border safety, environmental protection, aid to education, housing, transportation, science, space. All of those things were put in the budget to serve a certain purpose. They all have support for major sectors of the American population, so that when you sort of say, well, why don't we just cut spending? The reason we can't just cut spending, the reason it's not that easy, is that people have an interest. They have a personal interest in what is currently part of the budget. And when you try to cut it, people howl. And to the extent that the program is ever more popular, they howl ever louder. And it makes it hard to cut spending.
You point out in your piece that you can't solve the problem by simply cutting waste, fraud, and abuse.
Right.
The problem is simply too big, as you point out. Tough decisions are demanded. Would you tell us more about what those decisions would look like? What are the implications of making such decisions? And how do they relate to what government should do and what it needs to pay for?
Well, first, we should talk a little bit about this issue of waste, fraud, and abuse, because it is something that people focus on quite a bit. Why can't we just eliminate all the waste from government? Why don't we stop paying members of Congress so much, get rid of their limousines, and stop providing foreign aid overseas? The average person, according to polls, believes that foreign aid is approximately 25% of the federal budget. In reality, it's less than one-half of 1% of the federal budget. Congressional salaries, limousines, things like that are an infinitesimally small piece of the federal budget. Once again, as I said before, the federal budget is real things for real people. So to the extent that you're going to make a serious effort to balance the budget, it means that tens of millions of Americans are going to have to accept less or pay more in taxes or some combination of the two. And if you look at the major programs of government, we're talking about lots of people who get lots from government. Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, aid to education, as I mentioned before, national security, homeland security. Think about all the people who benefit from those programs. That's why it's harder than just this issue of cutting waste, fraud, and abuse. Should we cut all the waste out of government that we possibly can? Absolutely. Are people working every day to do that? Sure. Every department and agency has an auditor, has an inspector general, and they're looking to cut waste. But unfortunately, this problem is so big. There is such a gap. There is such a large budget deficit today and larger deficits as we look into the future that we simply can't fiddle around the edges and just cut waste and hope to solve this problem. It's much bigger than that. It's about cutting real things and it's about people paying more in taxes.
What's interesting, Larry, is in your piece, you acknowledge that federal deficits are nothing new in America, but the cause, size, and frequency have changed dramatically in recent decades. Would you elaborate on this change, and what are the implications of this new condition?
Well, you know, for most of American history, the federal government ran budget deficits for one of only two reasons. Either the country was at war, so it had to spend a lot more for the military to actually fight the war, or the country was in either a recession or a depression, and actually depressions tended to be a lot more common in the 19th century than they are today. And during a recession or a depression, the government suffers quite a bit by a lack of tax revenue because individuals and corporations are not doing as well as they otherwise would be. But, you know, from the beginning of the Republic, 1789, up through the early 1930s, so that's most of American history, after the war was over or the economy had recovered, the government ran surpluses to pay off the debt that had accumulated in the previous period. And in fact, if you look at the early stage of American history, keep in mind, we ran surpluses twice as often as we ran deficits. That changed in the early 1930s. Now we've got deficits that are much more frequent. We have deficits that occur almost every year these days, ever since the 1930s. And we don't run them only because we're at war or because we're in recession. We run them because we want more from our government than we're willing to pay for. And that is a real cultural change. We have become accustomed to deficits. And when you become accustomed to them, they're a lot harder to address than when you assume, as we did up until the early 1930s, that they were a bad thing and we need to eliminate them as soon as possible.
Well, the Depression, you point out in your piece, brought two landmark changes to federal budget making. Would you describe them for us?
Sure. And they have to do with what we were just discussing a moment ago by way of cultural change. First, with the collapse of the economy starting in 1929 and lasting all through the 1930s, people in a new way looked to Washington as the place to address their hardship. Until the Great Depression of the late 20s and early 30s, When the country was in a time of recession or depression, people looked to their local government. They looked to their county government. They looked to their state government. Only after that did they look to their federal government. Starting in the 1930s, first with Hoover and then with Roosevelt, people looked to Washington as the place to solve this problem. That's number one. Number two, there was a change in economic doctrine. For most of the country's history, it was taken as a given that balanced budgets under all circumstances were the right way to go. The balanced budget was the key to economic growth. And starting in the 1930s with the onset of Keynesian economics, a new philosophy took root and actually dominated the economics profession for quite a number of decades, which was that in times of hardship, such as the Great Depression, it is not only appropriate, but it is beneficial for the government to run deficits as a way to cushion the blow of the Depression and to move us back to recovery. And that's where we saw the onset of frequent and more acceptable deficits.
I'd like to turn to the idea of power and culture. And in particular, to what extent does power in Washington derive from the size of the budget that you oversee? What are the dangers of such a reality, and what could be done to change this condition?
Well, it is the case that power derives largely from the size of the budget that you oversee, and it plays out on different levels in Washington. It plays out at the executive level with regard to cabinet departments and agencies. Presidents ever since at least Richard Nixon in the 1960s have all come to Washington saying that the federal government's too big, it's doing too many things, we've got to sort out these responsibilities, and we've got to devolve power back to the states and localities. And every single one of those presidents, conservative, liberal, Republican, Democrat alike, has grown the federal government. They've grown the size of the cabinet. Cabinet has grown in a big way. We used to have cabinet meetings largely in the cabinet room of the White House. When the president wants to have a cabinet meeting now, he's far more likely to have it in the Roosevelt room, which is next door, because the table's bigger, the chairs are smaller, and you can fit the cabinet around the table. You can't really fit the cabinet around the cabinet table in the cabinet room of the White House anymore. You've got to go into the Roosevelt room. So it's really quite symbolic of how big government has gotten. Now, again, president comes to town, says he's going to reduce the size of government. Those cabinet members, they don't really have any interest in cutting their own budgets, because to the extent that they cut their budget, they've got less power. If they grow their budget, all else being equal, they've got more power. The same for the committees on Capitol Hill that oversee those departments. Why does every member of Congress want to be on the Appropriations Committee? Because it oversees more spending. If they can't get on appropriations, where else do they want to be? In the House, they want to be on the House Ways and Means Committee. It oversees the entire tax code and quite a bit of the human resource side of the spending component of the budget. So it plays out on Capitol Hill. It plays out in the executive branch. And frankly, it plays out in the private sector with interest groups that come to Washington and try to protect and grow what they have. In Washington, on K Street, on L Street, on Pennsylvania Avenue, around Capitol Hill, we've got one 12-story building after the other, all populated by the National Association of something. Teachers, farmers, big business, small business, and they're there for a reason. They're there to grow what it is they're getting from the government, a spending subsidy, a tax break. So everything is, in essence, incentivized towards yes and more. Yes, I want more of what I'm already getting. If you're a cabinet member, if you're the chairman of a congressional committee, if you're the head of an interest group. So power does derive from the size of your budget. And the reason it's dangerous is because it makes it very difficult to align the taxes we pay with the spending we want. We don't want to pay taxes, but because of all these forces, we want more and more spending. So it's no great surprise that we've got greater frequency of deficits and deficits that are larger than they've ever been before.
Larry, you've done a wonderful job setting up your piece. But I'd like to know a little bit more about you. Could you tell us a little bit more about yourself, and how did you come to contribute to the new book, Governing to Win?
Well, I've been involved in federal budgeting in some way for more than 25 years. I started in Washington as a journalist, wrote most prominently for National Journal Magazine, which is a prominent politics and policy magazine in Washington. I was there for 5 years covering budget and tax issues. After a short stint as a freelance writer, I went into the Clinton administration. I was the communications director at the Office of Management and Budget for 3.5 years, and then the communications director for Vice President Gore for a year. But when I was at OMB, of course, I was living the budget every single day. And then after I left the administration, I continued to be active on budget issues. I've written books and articles on budgeting. And so it's no surprise when the good folks at IBM were putting together this book and were looking for authors that they called on me. I know some of these people personally. We worked together in the White House. I respect them. They respect me. They came to me. They asked me to write the chapter. I wasn't shocked when they called.
What's driving the annual federal deficit and how are entitlements taking over? We will explore these questions and much more when the special edition of the Business of Government Hour, Governing to Win, returns. The IBM Center for the Business of Government has recently published Governing to Win, Enhancing National Competitiveness Through New Policy and Operating Approaches, edited by Chuck Pro, which brings together insightful essays by leading thinkers and practitioners that offer a long-term strategy to improve national competitiveness. How can our nation better compete in today's global economy? And how can moving to an enterprise USA approach in government enhance our national competitiveness? This book explores these questions and so much more. Governing to Win is available at bookstores, online booksellers, and from the publisher, RomanLittlefield.com. How can we enhance national competitiveness? What about getting big things done in government? And how can government better manage risks and use resources more wisely? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. Hear from Comptroller General Gene Dodaro, SSA Commissioner Michael Astrew, Coast Guard Commandant Admiral Robert Papp, NGA Director Tish Long, and Aaron Connaughton on the Air Force's strategic vision. All of this and so much more in the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine. Order your free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the special edition of the Business of Government Hour, Governing to Win, Exploring Ideas to Enhancing National Competitiveness. My guest today is Larry Haas, contributor to the recent IBM Center book, Governing to Win. Larry, in your piece, you note that spending has been increasingly dominated by entitlements under which people receive benefits automatically based on age, income, or some other criteria. Would you tell us a little bit more about the major government entitlements? Why have entitlements grown faster than discretionary programs?
Well, when people think about entitlements at the federal level, they often refer to the big three. Mm-hmm. Those are Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. Social Security is about one-fifth of the budget. Medicare and Medicaid combined is about one-fifth of the budget. So we're talking about 40% just in those three programs. The reason, and I should say that other entitlements are things like food stamps, civil and military retirement programs, and some other benefit programs. Now, the reason that they grow faster than discretionary programs is that they're automatic. That is, they continue from year to year. And because they allocate benefits based on age, income, or other criteria, some of those programs have growing constituencies from year to year. There are more older people in America each year than the previous year. More people eligible automatically for Social Security and Medicare. Healthcare costs are rising. That plays a big role in the growth of Medicare and Medicaid in particular. During times of hardship, other entitlements like food stamps and unemployment compensation grow automatically because there are more people eligible for them. So it's the combination of the fact that they continue year to year, unlike discretionary programs where Congress decides year to year whether to fund them. They continue year to year, and their constituency tends to grow year to year just based on natural growth of the population and other factors. That's why entitlements grow faster than discretionary programs, all else being equal.
What can we do to sort of remedy this imbalance, do you think?
Well, of course, in the most radical sense, entitlements do not need to be automatic. If we're just talking big picture here, you could at least envision a scenario in which policymakers, instead of letting entitlements stay on the books year to year automatically, they could expire year to year. And Congress could make a decision each year as to whether to fund them just like they fund discretionary programs. Now, that's probably not realistic because, after all, people have come to rely on these entitlements, particularly the big three that I mentioned before, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, to such a great extent that we're unlikely to be in a situation where we actually decide each year whether or not to have them. However, you certainly could change the formula under which they operate. They don't have to grow from year to year. Social Security retirees do not have to get cost of living adjustments every year to cover inflation. Patients and doctors under Medicare do not have to get automatic levels of benefits from year to year. So if we're going to keep them as automatic programs, one way to rein in their cost, one way to ensure that they do not grow at the rate at which they're growing is to change the way they operate, change the funding formulas, change the benefit levels of these programs. That would rein in costs. And we've done some of that over the years, but obviously not enough.
So, Larry, in your piece, you admit that more people who receive entitlement benefits, the greater number of constituents who mobilize to protect them. How does this behavior undermine the values that underpin the republic? And more particularly, how does it harm our global competitiveness?
Well, with regard to cultural values, you know, this is a country that was founded on certain principles and certain values, and one of them was thrift. I mean, you have... It sounds like a cliche, but it's really true. You have the old line from Benjamin Franklin, a penny saved is a penny earned. That was something that people believed back then. Balanced budgets were a real article of faith. Government budgets, personal budgets. Borrowing, debt was considered a bad thing to the extent that we are used to more debt, it does undermine this founding principle of the republic. Now, the reason it's dangerous is that there is a limit to how much we can borrow. At a certain point, credit markets are going to decide, our lenders overseas, our lenders at home are going to decide that they've lent us enough money. They start getting worried about their investment. Will they ever see it come back? Will the government continue to be able to make the interest payments on the debt that are owed each year? To the extent that there is an irresponsible federal policy, which is what we have right now, it does undermine competitiveness because responsible federal policy on the budget and everything else is a principle of global competitiveness. The more we have a healthy budget, all else being equal, the more competitive the country will be. So it has implications, cultural and economic, in a very real sense of the term.
Well, we talked about the entitlement side. I'd like to shift our focus to the tax side.
Right.
There's a parallel phenomenon unfolding on the tax side. The second largest government cost is tax expenditures. Would you outline why this is the case?
Well, first of all, let's talk about what a tax expenditure is. In many ways, it is the tax equivalent of an entitlement. First of all, the tax code, like the entitlement programs, the tax code is something that continues from year to year. It is underlying law. The government policymakers do not need to change the tax code. It will continue. Tax expenditures are tax benefits. They are deductions, credits, and other write-offs that are in the tax code. And they have grown just as the spending side entitlement programs have grown. And the same phenomena is true with regard to the difficulty of scaling them back. You will hear policymakers often talk about closing tax loopholes. When you hear the term tax expenditures, yes, well, we'll save money by closing loopholes. Well, guess what? Just like the spending side is not dominated by waste, fraud, and abuse, the tax side is not dominated by loopholes. Guess what it's dominated by? Let's see, the mortgage interest deduction, the deduction for charitable contributions, the federal deduction for state and local taxes, all of the tax-free treatment of 401k plans, capital gains investments, things like that, the tax-free treatment of employer-provided health care. Now, these are real things that people have gotten used to. I can assure you that a homeowner does not consider the mortgage interest deduction a tax loophole. Someone who receives health care from their employer does not consider the tax-free treatment of employer-provided health care a loophole. So cutting tax expenditures is just as hard as cutting entitlements, and it means that we actually have a problem, not just on the spending side, but on the tax side. And we're going to have to address both sides if we're going to restore responsible federal fiscal policy.
So in your mind, everything's on the table.
Everything has to be on the table. This problem is too big to limit it to any one side. It can't just be taxes. We can't possibly tax people enough to solve this problem only on the tax side, because taxes will be too high and we will lose our competitiveness overseas. We cannot, however, do it only on the spending side, because the gap is so large that if we tried to do it only on the spending side, there would not be support for the dramatic things that we would have to do to Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. And, by the way, it would be dangerous to do it only on the spending side, because the things that we would have to do for national defense would threaten our position overseas, our global leadership, our global footprint. So when we get serious, I can assure you that we will take steps on both the spending side and on the tax side. And unfortunately, we're not quite there yet.
So you acknowledge in your piece that not one category, and you mentioned it earlier, of spending or revenues fully explain the deficit in any given year. Would you elaborate on the factors that have driven huge deficits in recent years particularly?
Sure. We entered this century with budget surpluses. We, after lots of very hard and grueling activity in the 80s and early 1990s, we moved from a situation of large deficits to budget surpluses by 1998, and ran four budget surpluses in a row between 1998 and 2001. So what changed? Well, we had a recession in 2001, and a recession drains revenues to the federal government and forces us to spend more on things like unemployment compensation and food stamps and things like that. So that was a factor. A huge factor was all the big tax cuts of 2001 and 2003 that we enacted that are still on the books. We went to war in two places and did not pay for them, Afghanistan and Iraq. We added prescription drug benefits to Medicare without paying for it. And then most recently, we took some rather extraordinary action through federal bailouts and stimulus measures in 2008, 2009 to try to avert a financial crisis and to rejuvenate the economy and move us from recession to recovery. So lots of activity combined with a particularly poor economy, first in 2001, and then obviously in very recent years with the Great Recession of 2008, 2009.
So the problem is what comes next. And you point out in your piece that while revenues will grow from current levels in the future, spending will grow faster for two main reasons. And you note that these two factors feed off one another. Would you elaborate on the two main reasons and why they feed off or how they feed off each other?
Sure. What you need to keep in mind as you look forward is to focus on the singularly important issue of healthcare. First of all, we are an aging society. It costs more to treat an old person than a young person. Now, we have that in common with much of the world. Europe is aging. Asia is aging. So it's not like it's anyone's fault here. It's just the case that people are living longer, and that's a great thing. But while they're living longer, and it costs more to treat them by way of healthcare costs in America have been rising far in excess of the rate of inflation and growing, in fact, faster than the economy itself is growing. So put a focus on both of those things. Aging society, rising healthcare costs more to treat an older person than a younger person anyway, and now the coming, in particular, of the retirement of the baby boom generation, this cohort that was born between 1946 and 1964 that's just now becoming eligible for Medicare in particular, but also Medicaid, because senior citizens get their long-term care through Medicaid. So aging society, rising health care costs, retirement of the baby boomers, soaring costs for Medicare and Medicaid, and the longer you look out into the future, the more you see that our budget problem is essentially an aging and health care problem.
So, Larry, our discussion in your piece, to what extent is it a call to action rather than a call of despair?
Well, I tend to be an optimist. It's very easy to look around, see the paralysis in Washington, see the political gridlock, and assume that somehow we're never going to find a way out of our mess, that politics have moved in a certain direction, and what they mean is that we'll never come together on a responsible fiscal policy. But I would suggest that we keep a few things in mind. First of all, as I mentioned earlier, we did go through an era of very large budget deficits in the 80s and early 1990s, and through some very courageous action, through presidents of both parties, congresses of both parties, through various stages in the 80s and 90s, we took action that, combined with a strong economy, moved us from deficits to surpluses. It was not that long ago. In historical terms, it was literally the blink of an eye. If we did it in the 80s and 90s, we can do it today. Secondly, this country over time has always found a capacity to act when it really needed to. But you see, it comes down to Churchill's line about America. You can always count on the Americans to do the right thing once they've exhausted all the other options. We're still in the process of exhausting all the other options. But when we need to act, we've shown a capacity to act. We acted after Pearl Harbor. We acted after Sputnik. We acted during the Cuban Missile Crisis. We acted after 9/11. We will eventually act. I hope we act sooner rather than later, but eventually we will act. So, yes, very much, my piece is a call to action and a call for us to act sooner rather than later. But I am quite confident that eventually we will act. I hope it's sooner, but eventually we will do so.
Given the things that we've talked about today, to what extent has it come for government to be more future-focused, results-oriented, responsive, affordable, and sustainable for the 21st century?
Well, it's always a good thing for government to be future-focused. I mean, after all, this generation has a responsibility to future generations to leave the country in better shape than it found it. And every generation of Americans have managed to do that. This country has grown since the colonial period and has continued to grow through more than two centuries. So we have a responsibility under any circumstance to be future-oriented. But with regard to being future-oriented, results-oriented, responsive, affordable, sustainable, we have a particular responsibility to be those things today, because to the extent that we are going to be cutting back on real benefits and services that people get, to the extent that we are going to be asking people to pay more in taxes, it is incumbent upon policymakers to make sure that we do eliminate every single piece of waste, fraud, and abuse that we can possibly find in the federal government before we start asking people to make sacrifices. So it's always good to be future-oriented, but it's particularly incumbent upon us to focus on that today because of the situation that we find ourselves in and the things that we're going to have to ask people to endure in the years ahead.
So what immediate next steps, what immediate actions can be taken in this area?
Well, we're in the midst of an election year, of course, and it's difficult for policymaking to take place in very highly charged political environments. But this election season will be over in November. We will have either the second term of an existing president or the first term of a new president. We will have a new Congress one way or another. What needs to happen is soon after the election, the parties need to come together and understand what's at stake, because the future of the country is at stake. Our future competitiveness, our future global footprint, our economic strength, our living standards, the society that we're going to leave to our children. These are big issues. So what needs to happen is that the president, whoever he is, and the Congress, whatever its makeup, needs to come together in early 2013, set aside the politics, and use that year, 2013, to really make some progress on this issue. The good news is that big budget things do tend to take place in the first year of a new presidency or in the first year of the second term of an existing presidency. So there's great precedent for not just big budget decisions, but responsible budget decisions. The Reagan fiscal policy was enacted largely in 1981. The Clinton budget policy was enacted largely in 1993. I'm hoping that the responsible budget policy going forward, whether it's the Obama policy or the Romney policy, will be largely enacted in 2013.
Larry, it's a wonderful way to end. I want to thank you for joining us today. But more importantly, I want to thank you for your piece in the recent IBM Center book, Governing to Win.
Well, you're quite welcome, and it's been a pleasure to be here with you.
Next up, Gail Fosler describes four elements that are key to national competitiveness when the special edition of the Business of Government Hour returns. The IBM Center for the Business of Government has recently published Governing to Win, Enhancing National Competitiveness Through New Policy and Operating Approaches, edited by Chuck Pro, which brings together insightful essays by leading thinkers and practitioners that offer a long-term strategy to improve national competitiveness. How can our nation better compete in today's global economy? And how can moving to an enterprise USA approach in government enhance our national competitiveness? This book explores these questions and so much more. Governing to Win is available at bookstores, online booksellers, and from the publisher, RomanLittlefield.com. Welcome back to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, Governing to Win, exploring ideas to enhancing national competitiveness. I'd like to welcome my guest for the second half of today's show, Gail Fosler, president of the Gail Fosler Group and contributor to the recent IBM Center book, Governing to Win. Gail, welcome to the show. It's great to have you as my guest.
Good to be here.
So the classic definition, I mean, your essay notes that you can no longer define national competitiveness solely by measures of international trade and relative costs.
Right.
What trends have led to this sort of redefinition of national competitiveness?
Well, this is what you just mentioned is actually sort of my own definition. And within the economics profession, people would find that to be a bit iconoclastic. But what I think we have to simply look at the realities of American competitiveness by standard measures. And you look at unit labor costs, which is the, you know, our basic productivity versus our labor costs. And the U.S. has done better than almost any other advanced economy. In fact, you know, countries like Germany that are doing extremely well in the trade front have unit labor costs that are much higher than the U.S. So we have to ask ourselves, really, what's going on here? And the fact is that technology, labor, innovation is so mobile, and antitrust laws and regulatory laws, and there's so many things now that are common, that the world economy is really a very level playing field. To our friend Tom Friedman, the world is flat. And one of the few things that is separate, and separateness is kind of the core of traditional economic trade theory, the one thing that is separate is government decision making.
Interesting. How is these trends undermine the idea of competitive advantage that we traditionally understand?
Well, we usually, you know, thought of countries as kind of walled fortresses. And within each of those walled fortresses, you had more land or you had more resources or you had more people or you had some kind of unique combination of what we called competitive advantage. And you would use that, you would mix up those, that the potion around those resources and then lob your products into another fortress, all right? And then they would have, you know, less land but more people, and they would mix their magic potion and lob something else that was cheaper back into your fortress. Well, you know, that cost competition is really now a race to the bottom. And everybody tries to play that game. Some of the higher cost countries, again, as I said, Germany, are actually some of the countries that have some of the biggest trade surpluses.
So with all the changes or the way you've described competitiveness, national competitiveness, what are some of the key questions that arise as a result of these changes that you're describing? And is there a need for a new framework on how you approach the understanding of national competitiveness?
Well, I think that is the, you know, we've usually regarded government and governance and what I might call governing frameworks, that is how we go about identifying our goals, how we discuss our goals, how we discuss what are the most efficient means of meeting our goals as a country, what are the practices that we apply in the public sector in terms of delivering public goods and social goods. We've usually regarded that as sort of part of our domestic agenda. And what I'm saying here is that this is at our core, this is our national competitiveness agenda, because it is the one thing that among all those, you know, people, innovation, capital, financial flows, it is the one thing that is unique to our fortress.
In your contribution to Governing to Win, you acknowledge that throughout the 90s. And most of the last decade, the U.S. GDP grew faster than most other industrialized countries. What has become painfully clear over the last 5 years? How has it changed?
Well, I think what we all acknowledge now is that faster growth was based in part on leverage, which we have determined was painfully determined as unsustainable. And that it really did not, if one looks at per capita income or household income has been, median household income has basically been declining since 2000, with a little bit of, it had a little bit of blip during the last decade. But basically today it's like 10% lower than it was in 2000. And so we've not been returning the growth and the income from our economic model to the average American. I think that's one of the reasons why the electorate today is as cranky as it is.
So, Gail, this new view of competitiveness is underscored in a recent Business Council survey of national competitiveness, which you talk about in your article. Right. When leading CEOs of global corporations were asked to prioritize a list of key elements, attributes of national competitiveness, 90%, I understand from your article, agree that on four top elements. Right. Would you outline those four top elements for us?
Well, first is an educated workforce. Yeah. Second is having the resources, and that is not just the physical resources, but the decision-making resources to be able to meet your goals in the international international marketplace. The third is a favorable regulatory environment. And actually, I thought it was interesting that number four was what you call might call traditional cost competitiveness.
Interesting. I want to stay on that for a little while, because what I want to talk about is how some of the respondents talked about the U.S. gaining its competitive edge once again. And I think that something on the order of three quarters of them, of the survey respondents, identified specific actions that can be taken as the most effective ways to restore national. Would you elaborate on those actions?
Well, most of those actions align with the problems, which is we actually ask those questions in two different sections, and then we see if indeed there is an alignment. But education is really a very top priority of the business community. And in a more recent survey where we were asking about the presidential agenda, you know, looking forward into the election year, you know, usually education and energy policy wasn't particular to this competitiveness, particular set of competitiveness questions. But I was surprised that education and energy, which is usually very specific and it ranks fairly far down the list, these two policy issues ranked just under pro-growth economic policies and general budget and tax alignment. So these issues, I mean, the business community the business community is very consistent in wanting pro-growth economic policies, wanting an educated workforce, wanting a resolution of the deficit issues. Actually, they're very singularly aligned behind tax reform. Mm-hmm. And then finally, regulatory reform. So the things the business community wants stacks up very cleanly against those things they think would make America competitive.
I just want to focus a little bit more on the U.S. itself. You've done a wonderful job laying out the idea of a new national competitiveness paradigm. And really what I want to talk about a little bit is, from your perspective, at least in the piece that you've offered in Governing to Win, would you explain why the U.S. cannot cost-compete its way to economic prosperity? And also, what are some of the so-called competitive liabilities facing the U.S.?
Well, to begin with your second part of your question first, the competitive liabilities are some of the ones we've already talked about. The high cost of health care. One of the branches of economics looks at transactions cost. What does it cost to essentially transact business in an economy versus what does it cost to transform the product and the service? So, you know, you ask about unit labor costs, about cost competitiveness and the like. Those would be transformation costs. Things like healthcare costs are transactions costs, information is a transactions cost. Tax rates are a transactions cost. So, you know, you want to reduce both of them within reason, but which do not sacrifice things like the quality of healthcare, the quality of education, and the like. And so we can, if we look at, there's always another platform out there. Take China. Mm-hmm. We are all aware, we see on television, Apple computers, huge manufacturing facilities. You could imagine that those facilities might be in Northern California. If one were to look at the technology content, the way they're organized, the ability to turn over applications within a matter of a few months. So there's no way we're going to cost compete mm-hmm. with China because they, in that vein, because they have got all the technology, all the organizational capability, not just in the foreign investment, but in domestic enterprises, some domestic enterprises as well. So our ability to kind of pull ourselves together and make these decisions around education, around healthcare, around the innovation to reduce the barriers which have been in place for 30 years now that seem to be creating less new business development. There's a palpable decline in new job creation among small enterprises, which was always a strength in America. So those are now, I think, much more important than looking at these comparative unit labor cost measures.
How is governance the new competitiveness imperative? We will explore this question and so much more when the special edition of the Business of Government Hour returns. The IBM Center for the Business of Government has recently published Governing to Win, Enhancing National Competitiveness Through New Policy and Operating Approaches, edited by Chuck Pro, which brings together insightful essays by leading thinkers and practitioners that offer a long-term strategy to improve national competitiveness. How can our nation better compete in today's global economy? And how can moving to an Enterprise USA approach in government enhance our national competitiveness? This book explores these questions and so much more. Governing to Win is available at bookstores, online booksellers, and from the publisher, RomanLittlefield.com. Welcome back to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, Governing to Win, exploring ideas to enhancing national competitiveness. My guest today is Gail Fossler, president of the Gail Fossler Group and contributor to the recent IBM Center book, Governing to Win. You do a wonderful job, if you don't mind me saying, in your piece around connecting the new national competitiveness with global leadership. And I want to switch. Before we get to governance, I want to talk about that a little bit. And you point out that the U.S. remains number one as the likely future global leader. But you do note that the confidence in that has changed over the last few years. Why is that?
And I think because of our inability, that basically the confidence in our ability to sustain our global leadership is tied to the confidence in our ability to identify and tackle the country's most important problems. If I may refer to the survey that we just took for the Business Council in May, mm-hmm. it was interesting that although pro-growth policies and the budget were number one and number two, number three and new in the survey was the ability of a president to end the political deadlock and actually create a breakthrough in terms of getting resolution of some of these important issues. So I think that over the last several years, and I really, you know, extends back several years, that the inability to define what these issues are and then to come up, I mean, if we set aside some of the more, well, maybe energy is still controversial, but it seems as if there should be, we should be able to come to terms on a national energy policy. And yet it keeps getting swept out of the way. It shouldn't be as emotional as taxes or entitlements, and yet we cannot seemingly come up with a national energy policy. So how are we going to deal with some of these tougher problems? And when business looks overseas and they see a country like China, which is very statist in many ways, in the ways in which it makes its decisions, and very dictatorial in the way that they implement those decisions, we see ourselves wasting time, as it were, in the face of a key competitor that is very aggressive about establishing their international economic power and position.
I'd like to switch gears a little bit and focus on Europe and how it ranked. It ranked near the bottom in both competitiveness and leadership. Right. And despite its strong trade performance, why is it seen as neither a competitor nor as a candidate for global leadership, Europe?
Europe is viewed as, and this is all before the crisis. Yeah. Okay. It's all before their current crisis. I mean, we seem to be in a period where we have to identify which crisis we're talking about. But Europe is viewed as a high-cost, slow-moving, highly regulated environment with a relatively weak consumer and investment marketplace. So a lot of American companies have big operations in Europe. A lot of that is legacy from the 70s and the 80s. But these are not viewed as their sources of growth. And so when you look at Europe, and one of the questions we ask has to do with, have your business conditions in these different geographies improved or deteriorated in the last 6 months, and what are your expectations for the future? We were already picking up a very low level of economic optimism about Europe well before the current crisis.
So, Gail, would you define for us the term governance? What is governance?
Governance is basically the explicit and implicit rules that guide your behavior. Now, I'm using, I'm sure, a different definition, but I think it's important to recognize that the most pervasive form of governance is self-governance. Mm-hmm. We used to shoot people on the street. We don't do that anymore. I'm going to go home on the metro. At least I hope we don't. But when we think of what government did, okay, government actually, through the enforcement, and this has always been a struggle in various neighborhoods and like, government imposed certain explicit constraints, which then became manifest in behavior that reduces the need for what you might call explicit governance in that vein. So governance is the process by which we establish goals, by which we vet options, by which we choose and innovate, experiment with respect to options, public options. I'll use this now in the public context. And then we look for innovative ways in order to implement programs, approaches, regulations, et cetera, that achieve those goals in the public domain.
That's interesting because you've alluded to some of the challenges, but I'd like to talk more and maybe delve into some of the more core challenges around governance that we're facing today.
Let me respond to that question at two different levels. Okay. One is that I think our key governance challenge is that we need one.
Interesting.
I mean, we need a governance structure. The level of complexity of many of our programs and our and the complexity of our government. I talk frequently with some of my former colleagues and peers, and